With habitats that range from wetlands to prairies to forests to oak savannas, it's no wonder that here in Wisconsin we enjoy such a rich diversity of wildlife. And I think it's really part of our culture to notice and appreciate what's going on around us in different seasons. We're really fortunate to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven come by once a month to share what he's been seeing and to help us understand what's going on out there. Today, Scott joins us from a forestry field camp in Kemp Station, which is located between the towns of Woodruff and Lake Tomahawk. Scott, it's always great to have you with us.
Hi, Judith. It's great to be on, and it's just beautiful up here in the North Woods today.
Well, and what are you doing up at Kemp Station?
Well, when I retired last year, I kind of stepped back from our summer field course that started up here about 15 years ago, but the forestry part of the department has a summer camp for 3 weeks, and they brought me on board to do the cooking. So I'm actually chief cook and bottle washer up here for 3 weeks, but it's always nice to be at Kemp, and I've been able to help the students out a little bit with wildlife observations, and we had a nice fireside chat on wildlife issues in the North Woods a week or so ago, and it's just been great. The students have been great. The weather's been great. Lots of wildlife sightings. Holy mackerel, seems like there's bears all over the place.
Yeah, what are you seeing up there, Scott?
Well, we've got a loon nest fairly close around the point that we've been going by and checking out. The loon's sitting tight on the nest, an active eagle nest around the other direction. We've been watching that and watching the eagles bring fish in. And the students have had, I would say over the 3 weeks, which end this Friday, we must have had a collective 9, 10, 11 bear encounters, either ranging from, uh-oh, there's a cub and there it goes up the tree, where's mom,
mm-hmm.
to, oops, there's a bear crossing the road. So, been lots of bear activity, quite a few deer, one fawn found, so we're kind of at the peak of the season here. This 2 or 3 week span starting a week or two ago, depending on where you are in the state, is the peak of fawn drop, so there are new fawns all over the place. Let's see, I think we've seen one fisher. And just lots of bird life, and just they've caught a few snakes and done some reptile and amphibian surveys. It's been great.
Well, and I want to point out, I know, Scott, that you don't have access to Facebook today being up there, but I think you said the students have the computer lab all tied up. But I want to point other people to our Facebook page, because Jill posted a beautiful picture of what looks to me like a very young fawn just kind of struggling to its legs. Really lovely picture. So thanks, Jill, for sharing that. And folks can see that by going to the Larry Mealer Show on Facebook. You don't have to be a member. And it's Mealer is M-E-I-L-L. ER. You'll need to look under recent posts by others to see that. But yeah, it sounds like you're having a great time up there. What have you been cooking for the students?
Oh boy, we've had all sorts of things. Roasted chicken, meatloaf, nice thick pork chops. We're doing some nice ribeye steaks tomorrow night for the final night here before they all head back to Madison. Lots of pasta. No one's been hungry, and we've done very well. An army moves on its stomach, and so does a large group of students.
Well, I can see why they invite you back for your cooking skills.
Well, the students have been very appreciative, and that's always appreciated by me. And they're having a good time, and the KP crews have just been fantastic in the kitchen. So all in all, it's been a great 3 weeks.
That's great. Well, I know you wanted to mention turtle nests. Scott, is it a usual year for that, or has the strange weather affected them?
Well, the timing seems to be just about right. That was one other thing the students have seen a few of. In my many trips to and from the grocery store, I've only had to rescue one painted turtle from the middle of Highway 47, but the students have moved a couple out of the road going in and out of Kemp here, so things seem to be on course, maybe a little bit early, but for the next few weeks, I would expect people to still have a pretty good chance of seeing particularly painted turtles and snapping turtles moving across the road looking for a nest site. And it's the usual story. Help them if you can. Certainly avoid hitting them, but don't jeopardize your own safety by slamming on your brakes in the middle of the highway. But generally, over the last few years, it seems like when I stop for a turtle, I'm lucky to get stopped and turned around before someone else has stopped and moved it out of the road. So I think people have gotten that message, and turtles are in good shape for it.
And the bats are active now, too. I've been happy to see some around Madison in the evenings. Are all the migratory bats back in the state now?
Well, everybody's back and very active. In fact, the breeding season has commenced, and as a result of that, the new rules that went into effect, new DNR rules that went into effect last winter in response to a big package of bat rules and regulations in response to the threat posed by white nose syndrome. Mm-hmm. Anyway, part of that package essentially eliminated any form of bat control in terms of bat-proofing in household or outbuilding colonies from June 1st to August 15th. So we've entered that window now. So if you're coping with bats in the home or in a barn, shed, garage, or whatever, you cannot do the bat-proofing now. And in fact, no one really ever did. The word's been out for some time that it was inhumane and ineffective to try and exclude bats during the season when they were reproducing, mm-hmm. because you simply all you accomplished was to separate the females from their young.
Right.
And that was a bad situation all the way around. So for this roughly 10-week period, it's cease and desist on bat control via bat proofing. So this is a good time to keep your bat houses in order and mm-hmm. do other good things for bats. And then be ready to, if you are having a difficulty or problem, be ready to go come the middle of August, and you've got a window there of probably latter part of August and most of September, if not a little bit of early October, to do your bat proofing and exclude those bats from the building in question before winter rolls around, and they either settle in if they stay in the building mm-hmm. over winter or leave for the fall.
So, right.
All in all, the bat front is pretty active. The students, actually, another activity they did was a bat survey in our overwater boathouse here at Kemp last week with some DNR people, and they counted 108 bats coming out of the boathouse in the evening. So that was pretty interesting for them and pretty concerning to the person who does the caretaking work who would like to see them excluded. But, you know, bats tend to occupy whatever space they can find, and because of white nose syndrome, people are very concerned about bats in general right now,
right.
even though what's going on in the summer, bat houses and things like that have relatively little bearing on white nose, which is a winter problem.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, white nose affects them while they're trying to hibernate, really, because it wakes them up and then they use up a lot of their energy, right?
And they're goners.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of bad news released by the Wildlife Society a couple of days ago. White nose syndrome was detected in endangered gray bat colonies in Tennessee. Mm. And although they haven't documented any mortality yet, the fact that it's present in that endangered species is another blow to bats. And they also, in the release, upped the ante to somewhere in the neighborhood of perhaps 7 million bats killed by white nose syndrome to date around the country.
Wow.
So, still a big threat and a problem for bats.
But it has not been detected here in Wisconsin yet, and hopefully
it
won't be.
It's getting closer and closer, and mm-hmm. I think most folks are resigned to the fact that it's not if, but when. But the good news is we've had some advanced warning, and those new rules are in place, and the survey teams are out doing their thing, and sites that may be vulnerable are being as protected as best they can.
I was fortunate to be a volunteer at BatFest here in Madison a few weeks ago, and it was really impressive to find out all the different projects going on to try to both monitor and protect our Wisconsin bats. There's a lot of really good work going on.
A lot of great work and a lot of good people working on it, and
yeah.
it's rewarding because they were a species that for so many years were largely ignored or at worst persecuted, and boy, now they're getting the attention they probably deserved all along.
Well, we're talking with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. He comes here once a month or so to talk about Wisconsin wildlife and answer your questions. And Scott, as usual, there are several people who would like to join in the conversation, so let's go to the phones. And Jim in East Troy. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hi, Scott. It's a beautiful day in southeastern Wisconsin, too.
Right.
And I have a curiosity question for you. I have a cyclone fence that goes across the back of the property. And it's a standard galvanized piping with the regular web. The web is held in place by about 3/16-inch aluminum ties. And I noticed one day that several of them were broken, and there were a bunch of them that looked like they had been chewed on. And the marks, they look like teeth marks, are parallel to the upper holding and are actually breaking the ties. And there were probably out of 65 or so, there were 50 of them that were damaged, and about a half a dozen were cut clear through. Would a squirrel do that?
Yes. I mean, there are a number of rodents that have the capability. There's probably no other mammal that would be interested in doing it, but rodents in general, be it rats, mice, squirrels, chipmunks, things like that, have incisor teeth, those big buck teeth in the front that are very noticeable in a beaver, for example. Those are the teeth they do their gnawing with, and those teeth grow continuously so that they gnaw on things. In some cases, they're gnawing to get into something or gnawing on something as a food source, but they also do some chewing and gnawing simply to keep those teeth worn down and sharp. Now, I suppose it's possible that the local squirrel decided that that soft aluminum was something useful to chew on, but there's no other reason that you can look to that an animal might think, well, I really need to get in. Of course, a squirrel would just go over or through the fence, so that really isn't an issue. Nothing particularly attractive in the yard or no reason to think that any human activity is doing this?
Well, not really, because there are a lot of squirrels around, and they spend a lot of time running around on utility wires, and I've also seen them running across the top of the fence back and forth. So there's a lot of them around, and I was just wondering, they're about the only animal I think would be dopey enough to do something like that.
Well, it's quite possible, and they have the teeth to do it. Why they're doing it is anybody's guess. If you want to solve the mystery, that would be a dandy place to put up a little post, a T-post or whatever, and mount a trail camera and see what you get for photographs. I mean, you may have to sort through a lot of squirrels running along the fence top, but you might catch the culprit in the act and put an end to it. The other way to do it is to take some of the damaged connectors and look closely, perhaps with a magnifying glass, at those tooth marks. And if you see on the edges little paired grooves, then that's confirmation that it's the paired incisor teeth of a rodent.
Hmm.
And you can actually measure the width of those grooves and match those up in a field guide to mammals. There are incisor widths, and there's another great book called Mammal Tracks and Sign by a fellow named Elbrock, where you can also find the width of various mammal incisor teeth or rodent incisor teeth, and you can perhaps solve the mystery that way as well.
Well, if you're interested, I could send you a couple of chunks.
Oh, that'd be fine, too.
Okay.
You can send them to me at the university in Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and we'll have a look. And we've got all the skulls and teeth in the museum. I can compare the grooves and see if we can figure it out.
There you go.
Great. Thank you.
It'll be a team effort on the detective work. All right, let's go to Victor in Waukesha County next. Hi, Victor.
Oh, hi. Hey, Scott, I have a question for you. My wife and I are volunteers here and photographing the wildlife at Verno Wildlife Area. Mm-hmm. About for 3 weeks, we've been monitoring a set of trumpeter swans. Here's my question. They stayed for 3 weeks. On May 31st, the last time we've seen them, is it possible they're just exploring a possible site for the future, or were they just stopping and refueling and taking off to who knows where?
Oh, so they weren't actually nesting. It's not a case of nest abandonment. It's a case of the swans were there, and then they moved on.
We thought for a while they were doing going to bob their heads and do a mating sequence, but they didn't. You know, they're just, you know, just refueling themselves, going back and forth, trying out the different ponds here, you know, and then they just took off on the 31st. And we were just wondering, is that a possibility for a future resting area for giving birth?
Well, as that swan recovery and the population begins to grow, more and more places will have the potential for a nesting pair. It's large birds like that, swans and geese and so forth, it takes a few years before they become sexually mature. So it's quite possible that those were younger birds that were checking things out and so forth and then moved on to who knows where. Had they been nesting, it's possible, you know, nest abandonment sometimes happens or nest predators are a problem and the birds then leave the area and are disturbed. But it sounds like that was a couple of birds just checking things out and taking it easy, and they moved on to another area and might very well be back in the future. Only time will answer that question.
I have one question for you, Scott. Do you find that we start early in the spring, you know, in April, do you find it amazing how the vegetation in the wetlands come up every other day, once a week, and by observing this, as I photograph the insect world and macro, okay, mm-hmm. and the wife does all the birds and everything else. Are you fascinated by what different insects come flying through when certain plants appear for only a couple of days, and then they die off and a new set comes up and different type of insects arrive? Do you find this fascinating?
Well, it's all fascinating. I don't know how people, if they take the time to look critically at any natural environment, be it a wetland or prairie or whatever, all the things Judith listed at the head of the program, there are fascinating things going on every day of the year. And most of the events, from plant blooming and the insects that are associated with them and everything else, are all linked and are all timed to coincide in a very predictable way, which is one of the really scary things about the impacts of temperature change or climate change, where those things, some of those events, are starting to get out of sync. And if the plants bloom earlier, which many things do, I mean, lilacs were over so early mm-hmm. this year that, I mean, they were just gone before. I used to pick lilacs for Memorial Day, and they were gone 6 weeks before that. Anyway, if a plant blooms before its pollinators are available or active, then things get out of whack, and that could be it could be very troublesome in the future. The other thing you bring up is the constant change, whether it's in a wetland or any other environment, that unless you're kind of out there every day going for a walk on a certain trail, you only get these snapshots in time, and you don't catch that constant change in a particular environment. Much the same as, for someone coming up here to the Northwoods to vacation for 1 week a year, things always sort of look the same from year to year. But if you go way back in time, there have been tremendous changes in the Northwoods or any of our other environments, and unless you have some frame of reference to observe that, you kind of miss it. It's sort of like you look out the window of wherever you happen to live on a day-to-day basis, everything looks pretty much the same. But if all of a sudden you go visit the place where you were born mm-hmm. and haven't seen it for 40 years, holy mackerel, I mean, you're lucky to even find the place.
Right.
So those kinds of things are all pretty neat observations. So keep up the good work.
Thanks, Victor. And I just want to say that, yeah, their insects are fascinating, and there's so much to talk about there and wildlife in general. That's why we can have Phil Pelletieri on yesterday and you on today, Scott. Never be at a shortage for things to talk about.
Great.
And we are talking with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. He comes by the first Wednesday of the month to talk about Wisconsin wildlife with us. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, who will be back on Monday. Talking Wisconsin wildlife with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven, who is also chief cook and bottle washer up at the forestry field camp this week and the couple of weeks previous. So he's joining us by phone today. And Scott, we have several people online. So let's go right back to the phones. Judy in Appleton. Hi, Judy.
Hello. I was calling to ask Scott if he could speak some on the frog population. It seems to me, I summer at a small lake, and it seems to me that several years ago we were concerned about the frogs. If I'm judging from what I'm hearing this year so far, the frog population is as good as it ever been. I hear a great variety of different frogs, and they're very, very vocal.
Well, that's great to hear, Judy, isn't it, Scott?
That's very good news. I'm particularly fond of frogs, as well as all reptiles and amphibians, but there was a great deal of concern. Well, there's always been some underlying concern about amphibian populations all over the globe because of a variety of insidious environmental changes. However, the more immediate concern in Wisconsin was a few winters where we had some extreme cold, not so much snow. You get deep frost penetration and not much moisture, frog populations, and we also had some dry conditions. But things seem to have moderated a bit. We had a very benevolent winter. We had pretty good late winter and early spring rains, even though it's been dry lately. So the frog populations have, at least in some areas, probably bounced back just as you suggest, Judy. And at least here around Kemp, we've been hearing good numbers of most of the frogs that come and join the chorus as the spring and summer progresses. So frogs are very prolific at reproduction. If you give a few frogs a good breeding pond with no fish and no problems and decent weather and the water stays in the pond, they can produce a slew of eggs. And then you get a big emergence when those tadpoles metamorphose, and all of a sudden there's a real flush in the frog population. So I think that's probably going on in many locations across Wisconsin, perhaps not all, but we'll hope that what you saw, Judy, is indicative of a much larger area. So the upshot of the whole thing is things seem to have been going fairly well for frogs, at least recently.
And Scott, a couple weeks ago, actually, we had Rory Pulaski and Tara Bergeson from the DNR here talking specifically about Wisconsin's amphibians and reptiles. And if I'm remembering correctly, the Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey is still going on for a couple weeks. So I think people can still get involved with that if they'd like to.
People can still get involved and get a survey route and go out and survey those frogs, and those data from the Frog and Toad Survey, which has been going on for, must be close to 40 years now, are really the best barometer we have as to how the frogs are doing. So I'm guessing that if Judy or anyone else wants to go online to the Bureau of Endangered Resources, I suspect you can probably track down the data from the Frog and Toad Survey mm-hmm. and actually put some quantitative assessment to what they're hearing or seeing in their own area.
And we'll make sure we put a link up to that on the Facebook page again. And I was really interested to find out that the Frog and Toad Survey is done by sound, not by sight.
Yes, completely by sound. All of our frogs and the one toad sing relatively nicely, some better than others. But they're very vocal, and they enter the chorus in very predictable ways, from the wood frog in late March to the bullfrog and green frog in midsummer. And the toad surveys then extend across that singing interval. And again, as people assess frogs as abundant, common, rare, scarce, whatever, mm-hmm. get a nice feel for what's going on out there.
Great, thanks for that.
Wisconsin Nature Mapper site is another way for people to log on and see what's going on in their area from other observers, too.
All right. Thanks for that call, Judy. And let's move from amphibians to reptiles. And Jim in Mercer. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I have two questions for you. I see snapping turtles, currently, alongside the road laying their eggs. And I was wondering if there's ever been a survey done as to the survival rate, because it always seems to me day after I see the snapping turtle lay her eggs, the nest has been dug up and a raccoon or something has eaten all of the eggs. So has there ever been a survey done?
Sure, there have been lots, and generally nest survival overall is pretty lousy. A lot of the nests, as you suggest, are depredated by skunks, raccoons, possums, things like that, depending on where you are in the state. Especially when the turtles nest along a linear feature like a roadside cut bank or a railroad right-of-way or something, where all the raccoons that figure this out simply have to walk down the roadside and go from nest to nest. However, the snapping turtles have got two things going for them. Number one, they live to a ripe old age, so they have numerous opportunities to reproduce, and at least the snappers that may lay 40 or 50 or more eggs at a time, if one good nest escapes that predation and those little hatchlings make it to water, then that's a pretty good boost to the population. So, yes, the predation rate of turtle nests is very high, and there are people concerned about protecting nesting beaches and nesting sites, especially for the more unusual species like wood turtles and so forth. But enough snapping turtles seem to be successful that population is doing fine.
Thank you. The other question I had is, I've noticed, at least from my own observation, the population of songbirds. I put out a bird feeder every year, and last year and this year, I don't see the normal number of songbirds at my feeder that I have in past years. Is there any truth to that fact?
There's often concern either at winter bird feeders or over the course of the summer, I don't seem to see as many birds. There must be some environmental calamity or some explanation, or it's broad scale. And often it's just year-to-year variation in a particular site. Someone else has a big bird feeder up that didn't live in the neighborhood previously, or, there's a great field full mm-hmm. of insects and seeds nearby. The observation is usually not indicative of calamity. Now, having said that, there are many bird species, 400 plus in the state, and some of them are still having all sorts of problems. And there are a whole variety of websites that can tell you what a given songbird population is doing here and across the country. But these kinds of effects that you describe are often local, and I would counter it by just saying, before I came up here to spend some time at Kemp, and in fact, when I was home last weekend trying to do some things around the house for a day, both my wife and I commented, oh my gosh, we've never seen so much bird activity around the yard. And we're having trouble keeping the feeders filled, and there are nests all over the place.
Wow.
Everything from chipping sparrows to cardinals and rose-breasted grosbeaks and house finches and whatnot. So it's highly variable from place to place. Jim, I wouldn't be concerned. I think if you tough it out another year or two, your birds will be right back there again.
And also, Scott, I was just going to add that, you know, generally when we talk with our bird guys, Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, they often emphasize that feeders are really more for us than for the birds, that at the very most, birds are relying maybe 20% on what they're finding in feeders, and that it's really a way to bring the birds closer to us so we can see and enjoy and appreciate them, but that they rarely are really dependent on what they're finding in feeders.
Right, that's very true.
Great. Well, thanks for that call, Jim. And you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rhonda Fanning, our on-air producer, will get those calls into us. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org, and we'll get that on the air as well. Let's go to Bev in Rhinelander next. Hi, Bev.
Hi. I have a rough grouse that appears to be very enamored by me. It's been following me around on the yard. I'm assuming it's a male, and I'm assuming it's related to the breeding season. However, it seems to be very much in love with me, but attacks me periodically. So I'm wondering if you can fill me in on what is going on.
Well, Every year, the grouse literature is replete with stories like this, where a given bird has exhibited very strange behavior in terms of being attached to a person. And over the years, when I was wildlife specialist, it was unusual to not have a spring when someone would call with a report just like this. And some of them were really bizarre. I had a fellow a few years ago in southwestern Wisconsin who would start his riding lawnmower, and immediately the grouse would come out of the woods and come over and ride around on the tractor with it. And we've had others that would come up and literally make contact with people or wait for someone to show up and then follow them around the yard, sit on the wood, all sorts of strange things. And it is related to the spring breeding season. It is usually a male. And how they get short-circuited somehow from normal behavior.
Not that you're not probably very attractive, Bev, but...
it's just a really neat thing. And in some cases, the behavior's gone on for more than 1 year, and people become very attached and protective of the bird, too, and you know, go out of their way to try not to discourage it or injure it or whatnot. So I would say enjoy it while you have the opportunity. It's usually an opportunity to get some fantastic pictures of a rough grouse, which are otherwise darn hard to approach, and enjoy it for what it is. But it's apparently a short-circuited behavior that turns up from time to time and has all over the country.
Well, I have to tell you about trying to photograph it. When the first time it happened, I ran into the house, grabbed my camera, and I thought, the opportunity of a lifetime. I had a telephoto lens on it, in which we have to be 6 feet away from the object in order to afford to focus. And I had a dickens of a time getting
that
away
far
from
away. I had a cat that whenever I tried to take a picture of him, all the pictures were close-ups of him looking straight up because he would run straight at the camera every time. Wow. Well, do try to take a picture. Maybe as his amorous feelings subside a little bit, he'll keep his distance a little more and you can take a picture, Bev.
Okay.
Thanks so
Thank
much for
you.
That call. Actually, yesterday we had, in talking with Phil Pelletieri, a woman called and said that she had a butterfly that for several days, every time she walked out of the house, it would land on her and just ride around on her. And the only time that it would flutter off was when she went in the house. But as soon as she came back out, it would be on her again. So she had a little love affair with a butterfly going on.
Did Phil happen to mention anything about this? This year was apparently an unbelievable year for Red Admiral butterflies.
Yes, he did. actually. Yeah.
They just seem to be all over the place.
He actually said in general it's been a wonderful year for butterflies.
Good.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the phones and go to Nick in Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
Hey, I've got a quick question for you. I was playing PlayStation the other day, and I look over in the raccoon. There's a raccoon looking at me through the patio doors, which I don't mind, but I know they can be kind of vicious if they're cornered.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a 75-pound black lab that thinks that everything's a toy. Now, is that raccoon going to mess with him as long as he's not cornered? Or cause I know they can be particularly vicious once in a while.
Well, was this at night or during the day, Nick?
This was in the day. I was really surprised because I look over and he's just kind of watching me play PlayStation. I was like, and the dog knows straight away and he went running up there and the raccoon kind of puffed up and I was like, okay.
Well, you know, big raccoon's a pretty powerful animal and I wouldn't want a curious dog and a big, unpleasantly disposed raccoon to get together, but I'd be a little more concerned. You know, they really shouldn't be out roaming around in broad daylight and there are a number of things that affect raccoons and cause them to alter their behavior, things like canine distemper mm-hmm. and other such problems.
I call the disposal of him? Or?
Well, do you think he's still around? Have you seen him since?
Oh, yeah, they're around because I put a trail camera up there, and they're big. They're bigger
well,
than a house cat. And
there's
around.
A couple things to consider here. One is, okay, that individual raccoon may have been behaving strangely either because of disease or injured or it was thought there was a food source there, whatever the reason. The problem, of course, is that if you can't target the individual raccoon, I could tell you, for example, well, start catching them in a live trap and move them or contract with the Wildlife Control Service to move them. But the problem is there are so many raccoons in most urban, suburban environments that you're kind of cutting yourself in for a lifelong proposition to try and get the upper hand on the population. So I really think that's hopeless. I've had people, start doing that and catch 25 or 30 raccoons and finally throw in the towel. So I'd be tempted if that one shows up again very close to the house or there's one that seems to visit regularly, then you could perhaps position a good solid live trap, close to the window or close mm-hmm. to where you see it and remove that animal or, as I said, have someone do it for you and then hope that the rest keep their distance. But the reality is that anybody in virtually any neighborhood in Wisconsin who has a pet is in close proximity to raccoons mm-hmm. all the time because they're just so darn abundant and widespread. So if you don't see that behavior again, I guess I wouldn't worry too much about it. But if you do, I would try and target that individual. But just the notion of going out to say, I'm going to reduce the raccoon population in my area or my neighborhood is not going to happen.
Okay. Yeah, my backyard is a swamp, so it's a perfect place.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Nick. And Angie posted on Facebook, a friend of mine has a pond stocked with bass, crappie, and bluegills. They're all large and don't seem to have any babies, even though we can see some beds. Does he need to add some feeder fish like fatheads from a bait shop, or could that introduce disease? Is there a better option?
No, that's a good question for that individual to pass on to their local fish manager from the DNR and let them maybe have a look at the pond. A well-balanced pond that's got the bluegills and crappies are actually the prey fish for the bass.
Mm.
And if the bass are doing their job and you get a good balance, you get some nice-sized panfish to catch and eat, and the bass keep the little ones under control so you don't. The flip side, that's actually sort of a good problem to have if they're interested in fishing because the fish are of catchable size as opposed to the more common problem that the panfish are reproducing like crazy, the bass can't keep up with them, and you end up with an overpopulated, stunted population where all the bluegills are the size of a 50-cent piece and not of much use to anyone. So that's a question that a fish manager might be able to help them out with.
All right. And let's go back to the phones and Greg in Washburn. Hi, Greg.
Hi. I have a question for Scott. We're blessed to have an eagle's nest in our front yard. And
wow.
Last week, there were a number of blue jays that moved into the vicinity. They were all around in trees nearby the eagle's nest and squawking most of the day. And at first I thought maybe they were after caterpillars, and then I was wondering if there's some kind of a natural rivalry between eagles and maybe blue jays, things like that.
Blue jays are pretty aggressive, aren't they?
jays are pretty aggressive, and they're noisy, and they're conspicuous, but they travel in kind of family units and move around the landscape where they're nesting. I don't really think that they're much of a threat to the eagles, either high up. And what are they, in a big pine or whatever?
Yep, they're in a big white pine right on the lake.
So I don't think the jays are going to be overly concerned about the eagles. They might, if an eagle flew by, they might harass it a bit, much the same way blackbirds harass.
Okay. Of course, we're always worried about the eaglets.
I understand that, but I don't think those are big birds high up in the tree. I think what's happening now is more coincidence than anything else.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Greg. And if you get a picture of those eagles, we'd love to see one. Scott, I know you want to put a plug in for the Coverts project for landowners. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, the Wisconsin Coverts Project is a woodland wildlife management program for private landowners throughout the state. We seek out, it's run by University Extension. A colleague of mine in the Forest and Wildlife Department is the coordinator, and I've been involved with it for many years. It's a terrific program for woodland owners who are interested in becoming better stewards of their own property, but who most importantly are also willing to help us reach out to other landowners who can't perhaps attend a workshop on principles of sound forest and wildlife management on their rural properties. So in order to encourage this, we offer these Coverts projects. This year there will be two. They're four-day programs, run from a Thursday evening to a Sunday noon. And this year both will be up here at the Kemp Station where I happen to be, which is, as I've said, a beautiful place. There's no cost to the participants. The first one is August 9 through 12. The second one is August 23 through 26. And it's an application process. So for folks who own rural wooded property, particularly, you know, good-sized acreages, we're really targeting people with 40 to 80 acres or more in order to have an impact on the landscape, to obtain an application. They can contact my friend and colleague, Jamie Knack, who is the project coordinator. Her email address is jlnack, N-A-C-K, so it's J-L-N-A-C-K at wisc.edu.
And we'll get a link up to the project, too.
That would be great. And, again, we've got a deadline here of about mid-June, so there's still a week or so to get your week or more to get your application in. Then we take a look at the applications and select groups of 25 for each workshop, 25 landowners, and they're invited to participate. And the actual program is a blend of field tours, fireside discussions, classroom-type lectures, interactions with your fellow landowners. It's a really neat program. We have about a few over 500 trained Coverts cooperators, which is what we call our participants these days, and they're going back to their communities and doing all sorts of great things in terms of communication with friends and neighbors and the local community on good woodland stewardship. So it's a great program. If it sounds interesting to the listeners and you've got wooded property, I urge you to go to the link, get an application, and get it in soon.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, talking with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. He is sharing all kinds of great news about Wisconsin's wildlife and helping us zero in on what's going on right now. You can join in by sending an email to talk@wpr.org, or when our phones are not full, you can call 1-800-642-1234. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And just following up on that information, we just heard about the Midwest Renewable Energy Association Fair in Custer next week. Larry will be broadcasting live from Custer, as will Ben Marins, on Friday, June 15th. So be sure to tune in, or if you're there at the fair, be sure to stop by and join the live audience. And Scott, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, wants to know about the best side of the house to put up to install a bat house.
Bat house installation is very important to successful occupancy, and generally you want a warm exposure. Stay away from the north, northwest, northeast exposure where they're going to get wind and cool and not a lot of sun. They like to be warm. So south, southwest, southeast, east or west, where there's early or late sun would be preferable to any of the northern quarter. Higher is better than lower. I don't want the bat house in reach of either humans or potential problems or raccoons or whatever. So high up under the eaves, warm exposure, and by all means, be careful to not place the house over a picture window or your deck or something like that, because these houses are designed with open bottoms to let the bat droppings or guano drop out, and you don't want that accumulating in a place where it will be a problem.
And my understanding, too, Scott, is that you want there to be a very clear flight path to the house, so you don't want
right.
to the bat house, so you don't want a tree right in front of it or utility poles or something like that.
Right. The other guidelines beyond the exposure and the height is that open space is certainly preferable to heavily foliated or lots of shrubs or trees. And generally, the house is better than a pole, and the pole is better than a tree. A tree is a poor selection.
Mm-hmm. And even with all that, there's no guarantee that they'll move in right away or even
no, occupancy
ever. So
rates are not 100%.
Yeah.
And the thing there is, if you put up a house and it's not occupied, and you maybe try seeding it with a few bat droppings from someone else's house that it's not occupied, move it.
Yep.
Or put up a partner house, and eventually you'll get bats.
Great. Let's go to James in New Richmond next. Hi, James.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for taking my call. I had a interesting animal observation this morning. About 5:30 in the morning, I was woken up to a very high-pitched shrill, like a shriek or a cry, out in my front yard. And I went and looked at what it was, and it was a little fox out there in my front yard.
Hmm.
And I'm thinking it was a young, maybe an adolescent age. Is that the correct age for when they would have had their babies this year?
So it was tiny or small in that you suggest it was a new pup?
Well, it wasn't a baby or a pup, maybe an adolescent or a very young adult. It was a smaller fox. And it had an animal pinned down in the front yard. It was maybe a foot and a half, 2 feet in front of this animal, and it didn't really know how to get at it. I thought maybe this animal was a small woodchuck or something. I couldn't really tell. It was dark, and this animal was really hunkered down. You know,
who was doing the shrieking, the potential dinner or the fox?
The fox was. It would look over its shoulder back across the street from me. It's kind of an empty field with just really, a few trees in it.
Huh.
And it would look over its shoulder towards that, and about every 5 seconds it would give this really loud, annoying shriek, like a cry. And I was thinking either one or two things. I don't know if they hunt in, like it was asking for help, like, hey, I got this animal down.
Calling
here,
for backup.
They do communicate among themselves, and given the fact that it seemed like a sizable animal, a fox when it's not in heavy winter coat is not a very impressive animal size-wise, so it certainly could have been an adult animal. I think the pups would still be with their parents at this point. So chances are it was simply a small younger adult, for lack of a better term, and the shrieking was probably communication. I don't know what it had pinned down, but what was the resolution of the whole thing?
Well, my other guess was maybe it was a younger animal, and it had this animal pinned down, and it didn't know what to do. It was crying out for its mom to come help it.
Yeah.
It would try to get a little close, and then this animal would fight it off, and I watched it for a couple of minutes, and then I scared the fox off, because I figured what it ended up being was it was a neighbor cat, a little petite cat it had pinned down in the front yard, so I scared the fox off, and then the cat was able to get away. But I just, like I said, I didn't know if it would have been really interesting if he was calling for backup.
Yeah.
Either that or he was calling for his mom because he was kind of freaked out and he didn't know what to do.
Well, that may have been the less likely of the alternatives, but I'm guessing it was attempting to communicate somehow, but it sounds like it was just a fox that was a bit outmatched, and then your intervention saved the cat, and I guess everybody's happy at this point as long as the fox found something else.
Right. Well, thanks for that call, James. That was really interesting. And Al in Menominee also has a fox question, so let's go there. Hi, Al.
Hello. About a week ago, my wife and I were heading down a country road, and I saw a hen turkey out going down a fence line. And just as we passed, I realized there was a fox about 15 yards behind her. So we went down the road, turned around, came back. And by then, they turned and changed directions. They were only about 30 yards from the road, and that fox would be within 5-10 yards of the hen.
Mm-hmm.
And she would just sort of keep moving along and not dropping a wing necessarily, but she'd cluck at it, and sometimes she'd sort of aggressive to the fox. And one time she jumped up and just flapped her wings about twice and landed again. And the fox was a little worried about us, but the hen didn't seem to be. But I guess I've had fox come in and attack hen decoys. I just didn't think they'd be a full-size fox would be intimidated by the hen that way.
Well, there was no sign that the hen had any poults with it?
Well, we assumed that the grass was about, you know, knee high, so we wouldn't have seen them probably if they were there.
Well, I mean, foxes are very efficient predators, and a hen turkey out in the open, aware that a fox is present and staying ahead of it, turkeys are very fast on their feet, and of course they can fly. So the turkey probably didn't feel at any great risk, but under a different circumstance, a fox is quite capable of taking a turkey, and certainly poults and turkey eggs and so forth. So whether the turkey was moving away from a nest or poults the way a grouse and some other birds will to get the fox out of the area, we'll never know. But I don't think that the hen was in any immediate risk. Whether it had a nest or poults somewhere that it was trying to get the fox away from, who knows?
But okay,
Fox are pretty capable and pretty they have a wide dietary preference and will even take fawns, which are common in the environment right now. So I suspect its intentions were a meal, but whether it was intent on eggs or poults or the hen itself, we'll never know.
Okay. Well, thanks for that call, Al. And Chet in Athens is next. Hi, Chet.
Yes, thank you. I have a comment and a question. I've noticed the snapping turtles are out laying their eggs much earlier than usual, and my question was, do they lay their eggs whether or not they've been fertilized, or is that just every year they lay their eggs? And my comment is, the other day I saw a butterfly, I swear it was chasing a purple martin or a swallow. Have you ever heard of a butterfly actually engaging a swallow and kind of chasing it?
Huh.
So I'll listen off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chet.
Well, I think for an insect like a butterfly to intentionally pursue, I think that was simply coincidental. I can't think of another plausible explanation. You know, insect behavior is quite a bit different than vertebrate, you know, bird mammal type behavior, and you know, a butterfly couldn't keep up with a swallow or martin.
I was wondering if it got caught in the backdraft and just getting kind of sucked along.
I really don't know what to say there. That might be something that Phil could comment on a subsequent program. But I think what was going on was more coincidental or accidental than perhaps intent on the part of the butterfly, since butterflies are prey items for many
right,
birds.
Right.
That's maladaptive behavior. But, and as far as the turtles are concerned, there are enough snapping turtles around, so I don't think very many infertile nests are laid. But once eggs have developed in the female, then she's going to lay them regardless. And I think infertile nests are quite an unusual occurrence. So I don't think there's much there to be concerned about. Any nest laid is likely to hatch, and the little turtles emerge after, how depending on the temperature during the summer, 2 or 3 months of environmental incubation, so that usually by late August or early September, if the soil is moist enough and loose enough for the little nestlings to dig out, they'll dig out and then head for water.
How many eggs does a snapping turtle generally lay?
40 or 50,
wow.
Give or take a dozen, quite a few. And they're round and white, look like little ping pong balls.
All right. And Scott, what are you hearing about how the spring turkey hunt went?
Well, it was a good one. There was very nice weather, unlike the wretched weather last year. So there was nice weather. Hunters had plenty of time to hunt with the expansion of the 5-day hunts to 7 days. So with more time and nice weather conditions, the harvest went up about 6%, which was a very good thing to see. There were a lot of folks who were concerned that maybe turkeys were sliding in the wrong direction population-wise, and they may. But nevertheless, I think the weather and the opportunity conspired to bring the harvest up. 6% to about 42,600 birds, and those were taken by just over 200,000 permit holders. So, as usual, the overall success was in the neighborhood of 20% plus or minus 2 or 3 percentage points, depending on where you were and what time of year. Another interesting spin-off of the turkey hunt is that over 1,000 people participated in Learn to Hunt Turkey programs, which suggests that interest is still growing and the efforts to recruit new hunters and so forth, in, at least in some areas, seem to be paying off.
And are those primarily young hunters or are they hunters of all ages?
They're hunters of all ages. And while the emphasis in many cases is on younger hunters, I think the payoff for people who are 20-something, 30-something, or even older, they have the opportunity, the transportation, and so forth, to continue with turkey hunting if their interest is piqued and it proves to be something they're interested in. So overall, anybody can participate, and it's a great thing to do.
Phil Pelletieri wanted me to ask you how your turkey hunt went.
I'll bet he did. And he knows very well that my turkey hunt did not go all that well.
All right.
I had a great time, but no turkey was harvested.
Okay. Well, I'll make sure Phil knows that. We're talking with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. The diversity and richness of Wisconsin wildlife is one of the many things that make our state such a special place to live and that brings visitors from all over. And you don't even need to head to the forests or lakes of northern Wisconsin. You can go sit in a local park or even your own backyard and see more than you might think. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're lucky to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven as our guide to the outdoors. He has great ideas for ways to enjoy the outdoors and to be good stewards of nature. Do you have a question about our wildlife, or are you wondering about an interesting animal behavior you observed? You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. And I hope you'll visit our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. If you click like on it when you're there, you'll get regular updates on upcoming show topics. There's a lot more to talk about with Scott Craven, so stay tuned. We'll be back after the news. Each year that I live in Wisconsin, I really feel like I develop a deeper and deeper appreciation for our wildlife. And getting to listen to Scott Craven explain their behaviors and give tips on what to watch for has certainly made me much more observant. Scott comes by once a month to talk about the cycles of nature in Wisconsin, and we're happy to have him with us today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. Scott, thanks as always for spending time with us today.
Great to be here, as always.
And for those that might not have been listening earlier, Scott is joining us from Kemp Station up north, where he has been helping out at a forestry field camp. So he's by phone today instead of usually being in the studio with us. And Scott, we do have folks that are waiting to talk with you, but I want to make sure that we let people know about upcoming wolf hearings and how they can have their voices heard. There's actually one today happening in Spooner at the high school auditorium. The meetings all start at 6 to visit with an open house to visit with DNR staff, and then staff presentations begin at 7 with time for questions and comments to follow. So tonight is in Spooner. Friday is in Black River Falls. June 14th, there's a meeting in Fond du Lac. And then June 15th, there's a meeting in Rhinelander.
Right. These are all opportunities for the public to have input on the draft concepts to be included in the wolf hunting and trapping season rule. That rule will be going to the DNR board on July 17th in Stevens Point, and it's all a result of the governor signing back in April the bill the legislature passed calling for a wolf hunting and trapping season. So there are still lots of unknowns in terms of what form that hunting and trapping season will take. And this is an opportunity for people to have input on potential harvest quotas, permit levels, the season days, whole host of other things before that actually goes to the board on the 17th of July. So this is kind of the big hurrah, I guess, for the public to have some input on something that's proven to be fairly contentious.
And again, those meetings are happening throughout the, especially the northern part of the state. Spooner tonight, Black River Falls on Friday, June 14th in Fond du Lac, June 15th in Rhinelander. And I'm guessing that if you go to the Department of Natural Resources website and search for wolves, that you'll be able to get all those details. And since you brought up, you know, that this is to give input on something signed by the governor in April, obviously yesterday, the recall election, Governor Walker has held on to the governor's position. What do you see that as meaning for the future of the DNR?
Well, I mean, without attaching any value judgments to my statements, I'll just say that the primary issues that I think means is that there will be no immediate upheaval in DNR leadership. Now, for better or worse, I know there's a lot of controversy over recent decisions on environmental issues and enforcement issues and so forth. That kind of goes with the territory with a regulatory agency. But having said that, with the election going the way it did yesterday, we probably will not see a big shakeup with new leadership at the secretary or executive associate level or the various divisional posts. So that will mean some stability. How the continuation of that leadership will go, we'll just have to see. It also means another thing I was particularly curious about, depending on the outcome, if leadership had changed, with the upcoming report due at the end of the month from the Deer trustee, Dr. Kroll, and his two assistants, that's due at the end of the month, and had leadership changed, I think a lot of the impetus and steam behind that report, whatever it comes out to say, might have changed dramatically. But now we'll see where it goes. There was a very thoughtful piece posted just day before yesterday on the Wisconsin Outdoor News website, written by Tim Isley, a well-known outdoor writer from Madison. And Tim speculated on what this was now the day before the election, the way he thought things would shake out depending on what happened in the election. And for folks who are curious about some real detail on that, Tim did a very nice job of laying that out, so I think folks could find that on the Outdoor News website. So the main issue is there'll be no big upheaval in the leadership, and again, we'll see how that plays out.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Deer report coming up, the leadership that called for the report is still in power, so I assume some of the recommendations might carry a bit more weight than they might have if leadership had changed.
And we'll certainly check in with you as that report becomes available for your help in deciphering it. I do want to let people know that we got links up to the Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey and also to the Coverts Project up on the Facebook page. The Frog and Toad Survey is at WIATRI.net. And then for the Coverts Survey, or Coverts Project, sorry, it's FWE, like Forest Wildlife Ecology, .wisc.edu, and then a /Coverts, C-O-V-E-R-T-S. So you can go directly there if you'd like. I want to go to Bill in Madison. He's been waiting very patiently. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Scott, thanks for taking my call.
Well, Bill, that's what we're here for. What can we do for you?
As you know, vast wilderness forest areas have been closed to the public in Minnesota, Montana, and in many other states, but not yet in Wisconsin, and hopefully never will. Two other fast comments, and then you can answer that. I used to work as a young person when they were creating a taconite tailings pond and plant in Silver Bay, and the public tried to warn them about the poisonous trace minerals that would go into Lake Superior, and nobody listened, and they ruined the most beautiful lake, largest lake, for producing the largest herring in the world. Totally ruined those trace elements, killed the spawning beds. Then, now they're talking about having these poisonous trace elements. As you know, I'm a PhD biochemist, but not smart like you. They're thinking about having these poisonous trace elements go from Wisconsin up through the Indian Reservation into Lake Superior to continue with this poisoning of our precious waters.
Okay, Bill, I'm going to ask you to stop there because that's a little off topic. But Scott, did you want to respond to that at all?
Well, we've talked with Bill many times before, and I'm not sure where the closure of public land issue was coming from. I, too, hope that our public lands, which are very important in Wisconsin for all sorts of outdoor recreation, are never jeopardized. That, in fact, is one of the topics that's been quite contentious over the last couple of weeks when it was released that perhaps the deer trustee, Dr. Kroll, had made comments. This turned out to be a number of years ago that public lands were not, at least from his background in Texas, what we feel or value here in Wisconsin, and that perhaps things should move more toward privatization and so forth. I think in looking at that, those comments were made quite a few years ago, and the discussion of them may have been more of a political discussion prior to yesterday's election than they should have been. So if Will's right, public land's very important. It should not be impinged upon in any way, so that's a good thing. And as far as taconite, tailings, and other environmental issues, there's going to be a discussion here at Kemp next week. A variety of state leaders, a leadership institute coming in with a discussion in Minocqua a week from Friday on environmental issues focused on mining issues. So people are thinking about this kind of thing, and we just have to hope our leadership will provide the protection that we all want for the environment and for our public lands.
All right, and let's go to Joan in the North Woods now. Hi, Joan.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Scott, I saw an animal, but I want to preface that before I tell you that. I saw a full-grown bobcat looking out of, I'm not far from a lake. I can see the lake from my house, and I have these long windows. And so I just looked out. I'm new to the area, and I saw this animal just sitting there. And I said, oh, look at that. And it was big, okay? And it was just sitting. And I said, oh, you know, what is it? Anyway, after I described it to people, they said, oh, it's a bobcat. Okay. So then about 2 weeks later, over my patio, I see two little heads. And I said, oh, they look like kittens. You know, I've had cats, and I keep looking at this, and I said, the heads are too big, and there's wisps coming out of the ears long, you know.
Uh-huh.
And this patio goes down probably a foot to the ground, but there's big rocks that they could stand on, so I never got to see the hands. All I saw was the heads.
Mm-hmm.
So they left. Now, the other day, I was looking up, just glanced out my window, and I saw an animal going by, and it was a blush red, not real red, but just a blush. But it had horizontal stripes on the body, and but they were broken. But when I noticed it already, the animal was moving away, and all I saw was the body, and. So I was just wondering what this was, and since I'd already seen these babies and that adult, I figured that there must be a nest nearby, but I'm wondering about this animal that I saw.
What do you think, Scott?
Well, I think you probably do have a bobcat den nearby, and you got to see a couple kittens and one of the adults. So that's a neat sighting. People don't get to see bobcats very often. They're beautiful but secretive. So that's that. As far as this blush red animal with stripes. How big was this animal? Was it a big animal or a small animal?
I would say it's probably an adolescent.
But size-wise, what would you compare it to?
But bigger than a bread box? I mean, you know, squirrel size, deer size, or something?
Bigger. I would think I would compare it to a one of my cats. My cat, you know, full-grown cat.
So, like a house cat size.
Well, I'm not sure what to tell you about that. This time of year, the deer have taken on a bright, rusty, reddish appearance, and of course there are fawns moving around, and I'm just wondering if shadows or whatever might have given the appearance of stripes. We just don't have much that I would describe as a striped animal.
It was a marking, definitely a marking.
Because you said it was kind of a broken up line, which I wonder if that couldn't be the spots on a fawn.
Hmm. But well, that's possible. I mean, I just can't. Nothing comes to mind by way of stripes, other than the
stripes were broken. It was, like they weren't just definite. Every so often, there were broken.
Okay.
And the stripes were dark or light?
I would say they were dark.
Well, that's a good one. I there are all sorts of aberrations and anomalies, but in terms of medium-sized striped animals in this environment, there just isn't much to choose from, especially with a reddish coloration, unless we were thinking about, are there other folks? Are you kind of out in the countryside, or are there other
folks?
Yes,
I am. I'm in the North Woods.
Well,
this seems to be a path, because I've had a bear use this path, and animals come in out of the bush,
mm-hmm.
out of the woods.
Well, the bobcat sighting, Joan, that was great. As far as what you saw that was reddish and striped, that's got me a bit baffled. But hey, you seem to see things regularly. Maybe it'll come back and get a better look at it or a picture, and we'll figure it out.
All right, thanks for that call, Joan. And let's go next to Bill in West Salem. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Judy and Scott. Scott, I have a question regarding a slogan, and I've heard it on your show once before. Mm-hmm. Sumer goes like this: eyes in front made the hunt, eyes in the side made the hide, and then there's more to that. Do you know the rest of that slogan, Scott?
The genesis of the slogan is a description of the way eye placement occurs on certain mammals, and typically predators. Their eyes are closer together, focused forward, so they can use binocular vision to judge speed and distance and make for effective capture. Whereas if you look at the eye placement on a cottontail rabbit or a deer, they're more lateral to give them a big, wide field of view so they can detect problems coming, like the aforementioned predators. So that's the genesis. What comes next? Then that's fairly common in biology, or even to see in textbooks. But I'm not aware of what the follow up would be.
Okay, I've heard it before, and I really don't know the rest of it. But
I don't know. I know where that comes from in terms of the eye placement, and there may be some follow up that deals with ears or hearing or some of the other sensory mm-hmm. capabilities of predators versus prey. But I don't know. Maybe we can turn to the audience here and somebody can help us out.
Great, and thanks for that call, Bill. And you are listening to The Larry Miller Show. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry and talking with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. Let's go to Kay in Prairie du Sac next. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I have all kinds of bird food out, different kinds of seed, and I have three feeders with grape jelly and mealworms on them, and they're tiny little saucers on the top of quite thin wires stuck in the ground. And every night, those are clean as a whistle during the night, and they're licked clean, and whatever is doing it, the wires are so thin, it can't be a raccoon. You know, they would have bent it, and they're in my flower bed, and there's no traffic there. There's no plants that are broken off. And I wondered if something like that would be a flying squirrel that would eat jelly.
Well, I certainly think that's possible. My jelly feeder, we had a poor oriole season this year, and that's why I have the jelly out. I suspect it's why you have it out as well. But there are quite a few other birds in particular that will use jelly that may be operating, early and late, not necessarily in the dark, but the house finches really work over the jelly that I put out. But I think that as far as night activity, any high-energy sweet food source like that is going to be very attractive to a lot of things. If you're, I can imagine a deer walking by, for example, and if these aren't very far off the ground, a couple of licks and that stuff is gone. If flying squirrels could glide in and so forth. But a flying squirrel's a pretty good-sized mammal, and for them to glomp onto what you describe as a little saucer and not bend the wire over might be a little bit tricky. But I suspect, how high off the ground would you say these little saucers are?
About 2 feet, and I'm in town, and they've been licked. It's not a bird.
I don't think 2 feet is beyond the realm of possibility for a whole host of things, even a raccoon standing on its hind legs.
Okay.
you know, a good-sized raccoon might still be able to get to it, and I still think, too, a deer walking by would just lick that clean in a heartbeat.
Right.
So I think there are a couple possibilities, and it probably isn't birds, but there are a bunch of mammals that might be involved.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the wire is small enough in diameter, something like a white-footed mouse or something like that, a very adept climber, shinny up that wire, and it would be gone very quickly.
If I put out a red light, would that deter any of the animals?
Actually, red light doesn't really discourage them. In fact, for folks who want to observe flying squirrels, we often recommend that you put a red filter on your floodlights or something so you can get the squirrels used to your watching and then eventually go back to a white light so you can actually see them pretty well. There are a variety of strategies that you might use to discourage that, including putting the saucers inside a cone of chicken wire or something like that. But frankly, I think it would be just easier to raise the saucers up high.
That sounds like it. Well, thanks for that call, Kay. And actually, since Kay brought up flying squirrels, are they found all over the state, Scott?
Yes, they're beautiful little animals. They're strictly nocturnal, so it's very unusual to see them during the day unless you happen to cut an old tree for firewood and disturb a nest. But they're regular feeder visitors, and if you do get them coming in and can condition them to your presence, which isn't all that difficult, they're a very attractive little things to watch. Very soft and fuzzy, great big dark eyes, and that big flat rudder-like tail. We have a southern flying squirrel and a northern flying squirrel. Southern flying squirrels are found pretty much statewide. The bigger northern flying squirrels found up in this countryside where I'm currently hanging out. But neat animal if you get a chance to see them.
Let's take a quick call from Deborah in Brown Deer. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I live in a really amazing area. I like sandwich in Brown Deer between Brown Deer Park, the Milwaukee River, and then there's been a river, it's like a South Branch Creek, which is, they just recently connected the interurban trail to the Oak Creek Trail. And so I see amazing, amazing wildlife here. In fact, I even think I saw a badger this past winter, but it hasn't been confirmed, and I've called DNR people. But last Sunday I was riding my bike on just north of Brown Deer Road on the interurban trail, and I saw this recumbent bike coming, and I thought, oh, that's so cool. And then I saw something even cooler. It was like 30 feet later, a frog. It was the largest frog I'd ever seen right in the middle of the trail. So I got my bike, got off my bike, and started and observed the frog, got him on my camera, and he had his foot run over. So finally a man assisted and got another man stopped up, and he's like, oh, it's just a bullfrog. And I'm like, something's wrong, you know, and he kicked him like with his foot. I'm like, don't do that. And so I got a little inchworm from the eat. I was there for 20 minutes trying to figure out if I should just let nature take its course, or I didn't know what to do.
So Scott, what would you recommend for someone like Deborah that comes across an injured animal?
Well, I mean, generally, the advice is that potentially orphaned or animals that we think are orphaned or injured may be quite able to take care of themselves, and it's generally better to leave them alone. If, however, the injury is clear, like this bad foot on a frog, the animals are also amazingly resilient and capable of healing injuries that, you know, a human would just be debilitated completely. So again, if you can move the animal out of harm's way so it isn't going to be run over, stepped on, picked up, or whatever, then that's often the best course of action. But we also have a wonderful network of wildlife rehabilitators in the state. Those can usually be tracked down through DNR offices or the Wisconsin Wildlife Rehabilitators Association website, or any nearby big nature center can usually put you in touch with a rehabber, and the injured animal can be taken in for care. That's the best strategy.
All right. And so in the moment, I mean, and obviously, you know, people want to be safe, too. So a frog, probably not a big deal to move.
But an injured raccoon or something like that, that's an animal that deserves a wide berth, and it can be reported, but don't mess with them.
And Bridget actually posted on the Facebook page a photo of a raccoon that had been evading her capture for quite a while. She says, "This fellow has been evading my trap for a long time. He ate 3 goose eggs and my geese quit laying after that. Now he's been climbing my platform feeder, licking the grape jelly container clean." So there you go. Maybe it's the same one. "And ripping the screen floor in it, but I got him." And it's a picture of him sitting not very contentedly in a cage. So good work on that, Bridget. And good work to you, Scott. Thanks again for joining us and sharing your knowledge and experience.
Thanks again. Have a great day.
You too. And Scott will actually be back on Wednesday, July 11th, the second Wednesday of July, because we'll be doing our traditional bird show on the 4th of July. And I am Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. He will be back on Monday. Tomorrow, I'll be talking with Sandy Chalmers and Michelle Reinen from the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. They have some great examples of the old saying, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. So they'll help us out on that. Thanks so much for listening, and hope you'll tune in and stay tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.